This is Audible.
This is a copyrighted work. Unauthorized copying or distribution is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000.
Scholastic Audio presents City of Ghosts by Victoria Schwab. Read by Reba Burr. To die will be an awfully big adventure. J.M. Barrie, Peter Pan. Part 1. The Inspectors. Chapter 1. People think that ghosts only come out at night, or on Halloween when the world is dark and the walls are thin. But the truth is, ghosts are everywhere. In the bread aisle at your grocery store, in the middle of your grandmother's garden, in the front seat on your bus. Just because you can't see them doesn't mean they aren't there. I'm sitting in history class when I feel the tap, tap, tap on my shoulder, like drops of rain. Some people call it intuition, others second sight. That tickle at the edge of your senses, telling you there's something more. This isn't the first time I've felt it, not by a long shot. Not even the first time I've felt it here at my school. I've tried to ignore it, I always do, but it's no use. It wears away at my focus, and I know the only way to make it stop is to give in. Go and see for myself. From across the room, Jacob catches my eye and shakes his head. He can't feel that tap, 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 but he knows me well enough to know when I do. I shift in my seat, forcing myself to focus on the front of the classroom. Mr. Meyer is valiantly trying to teach despite the fact it's the last week of school before summer vacation.
Toward the end of the Vietnam War in 1975, U.S. troops,
my teacher drones on. Nobody can sit still, let alone pay attention. Derek and Will are sleeping with their eyes open. Matt is working on his latest paper football. Alice and Melanie are making a list. Alice and Melanie are popular kids. You can tell because they look like copies. Same shiny hair, same perfect teeth, same painted nails. Where I'm all elbows and knees, round cheeks and curly brown hair. I don't even own nail polish. I know you're supposed to want to be one of the popular kids, but the truth is, I never have. It just seems like it would be exhausting, trying to keep up with all the rules. Smile, but not too wide. Laugh, but not too loud. Wear the right clothes, play the right sports. Care about things, but never care too much. Jacob and I have rules too, but those are different. As if on cue, Jacob stands up and makes his way toward Melanie's desk. He could be a popular kid, I think, with his floppy blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and good humor. He shoots me a devilish look before perching on the edge of her desk. He could be, but there's just one problem. Jacob's dead.
Things we need for movie night, he reads aloud from Melanie's paper.
But I'm the only one who can hear him. Melanie folds another sheet, an invitation, I can tell by the capital letters, the pink pen, and reaches forward to pass it to Jenna, who sits in front of her. As Melanie does this, her hand goes straight through Jacob's chest. He looks down as if offended, then hops off the desk. Tap, tap, tap goes the feeling in my head, like a whisper I can't quite hear. Impatient, I check the clock on the wall waiting for the lunch bell. Jacob meanders over to Alice's desk next, examining the many multicolored pens she keeps lined up across the top. He leans in close and gingerly brings one of his fingers to the pens, all his focus narrowed on the nearest one as he pokes it. But the pen doesn't move. In the movies, poltergeists can lift televisions and slide beds across the floor. But the truth is, it takes a lot of spirit power for a ghost to reach across the veil, the curtain between their world and ours. And the ghosts that do have that kind of strength, they tend to be really old and not very nice. The living may take strength from love and hope, but the dead grow strong on darker things, on pain and anger and regret. Jacob furrows his brow as he tries and fails to flick Matt's paper football. I'm glad he's not made of all that stuff. I don't actually know how long Jacob's been dead. I think the word quietly because I know he doesn't like it. It can't have been that long, since there's nothing retro about him. He's got on a superhero t-shirt, dark jeans, and high tops. But he doesn't talk about what happened, and I don't ask. Friends deserve a little privacy, even if he can read my mind. I can't read his, but all things considered, I would rather be alive and not psychic than psychic and a ghost. He looks up at the word ghost and clears his throat.
I prefer the phrase corporeally challenged.
I roll my eyes because he knows I don't like it when he reads my mind without asking. Yes, it's a weird side effect of our relationship, but come on, boundaries.
It's not my fault you think so loud,
Jacob replies with a smirk. I snort and a few students glance my way. I sink lower in my chair, my sneakers knocking against my book bag on the floor. The invitation Melanie passed to Jenna makes its way around the room. It doesn't stop at my desk. I don't mind. Summer is almost here, and that means fresh air and sunshine and books to read for fun. It means the annual family trek down to the rented beach house on Long Island, so Mom and Dad can work on their next book. But most of all, it means no hauntings. I don't know what it is about the beach house, maybe the fact that it's so new, or the way it sits on a calm stretch of shore, but there seem to be far fewer ghosts down there than here in upstate New York, which means that as soon as school's out, I get 6 full weeks of sun and sand and good night's sleep. 6 weeks without the tap, tap, tap of restless spirits. 6 weeks of feeling almost normal. I can't wait for the break. I can't wait, and yet the moment the bell rings, I'm up, backpack on one shoulder and purple camera strap on the other, letting my feet carry me toward that persistent tap, tap, tap.
Crazy idea, says Jacob, falling into step beside me. But we could just go to lunch.
It's Meatloaf Thursday, I think, careful not to answer out loud. I'd rather face the ghosts.
Hey now, he says.
But we both know Jacob's not a normal ghost, just like I'm not a normal girl. Not anymore. There was an accident. A bike. A frozen river. Long story short, he saved my life.
Yeah, I'm practically a superhero,
Jacob says right before a locker swings open in his face. I wince, but he passes straight through the door. It's not that I forget what Jacob is. It's pretty hard to forget when your best friend is invisible to everyone else. But it's amazing what you can get accustomed to. And it says something that the fact that Jacob's been haunting me for the past year isn't even the strangest part of my life. We hit the split in the hall. Left goes to the cafeteria, right goes to the stairs.
Last chance for normal, Jacob warns,
but he's got that crooked grin when he says it. We both know he passed normal a long time ago. We go right. Down the stairs and along another hall, against the flow of lunchtime traffic and with each turn, the tap, tap, tap gets stronger, turning into a pull, like a rope. I don't even have to think about where to go. In fact, it's easier if I stop thinking and just let it reel me in. It draws me to the doors of the auditorium. Jacob shoves his hands in his pockets and mutters something about bad ideas, and I remind him he didn't have to come, even though I'm glad he did.
Ninth rule of friendship, he says. Ghost watching is a two-person sport.
That it is, I say, snapping the cap off my camera lens. It's a clunky old beast, this camera, a manual with a busted viewfinder and black and white film, hanging off my shoulder on its thick purple strap. If a teacher catches me in the auditorium, I'll say I was taking photos for the school paper, even though all the clubs have ended for the year. And I never worked for the paper. I push open the auditorium doors and step inside. The theater is huge, with a high ceiling and heavy red curtains that hide the stage from view. Suddenly, I realize why the tap, tap, tap has led me here. Every school has stories, ways to explain that creaking sound in the boys' bathroom, that cold spot at the back of the English room, the smell of smoke in the auditorium. My school's the same. The only difference is that when I hear a ghost story, I get to find out if it's real. Most of the time it's not. A creaky sound is just a door with bad hinges. A cold feeling is just a draft. But as I follow the tap, tap, tap down the theater aisle and up onto the stage, I know there's something to this particular story. It's the one about a boy who died in a play. Apparently, a long, long time ago, when the school first opened, there was a fire in the second act of A Midsummer Night's Dream. The set went up in flames, but everyone got out, or so they thought, until they found the boy under the trap door. Jacob shivers beside me and I roll my eyes. For a ghost, he scares so easily.
"Have you ever thought," he says, "that you don't scare easily enough?"
But I scare just as easily as anyone. Believe it or not, I don't want to spend my time searching for ghosts. It's just that if they're there, I can't ignore them. It's like knowing there's someone standing right behind you and being told not to turn around. You can feel their breath on your neck, and every second you don't look, your mind just makes it worse, because in the end, what you don't see is always scarier than what you do. I climb onto the stage, Jacob at my heels. I can feel him hesitating, his own reluctance dragging me back as I pull up a corner of the heavy red curtain and slip backstage. Jacob follows, passing straight through the curtain. It's dark here. So dark, it takes a second for my eyes to adjust to the various props and benches scattered across the stage. A thin ribbon of light comes from beneath the curtain. It's quiet, but there's an eerie sense of motion. The faint groan of sandbags settling on their hinges, the whisper of air beneath the floorboards, the rustle of what I hope is paper and not rats. I know that some of the older kids in school dare each other to go back here, to put their ear to the floor and listen for the boy who didn't make it. I heard them bragging about it once in the hall, how long they'd each lasted. 1 minute, 2, 5. Some claim they heard the boy's voice. Others say they smelled smoke, heard the footsteps of fleeing children. But it's hard to know where the rumors end and the truth picks up. Nobody dared me to come here. They didn't have to. When your parents write books about paranormal activity, people assume you're weird enough to go on your own. I guess they're right. I'm halfway across the darkened stage when I trip over something and stumble forward. Jacob's hand shoots out to catch me, but his fingers go through my arm, and I bang my knee on the wooden floor. My palm smacks hard, and I'm surprised when the floor bounces a little, until I realize I'm on top of the trapdoor. The tap, tap, tap grows more insistent under my hands. Something dances at the edge of my sight. A thin gray curtain caught in a constant breeze, different from the heavy red stage curtain. This one, no one else can see. The veil. The boundary between this world and somewhere else, between the living and the dead. This is what I'm looking for. Jacob shifts his weight from foot to foot. Let's get this over with. I get back to my feet. Ghost five, I say for luck. A ghost five is like a high five for friends who can't really touch. It's basically just me putting out my hand and him pretending to hit it, both of us murmuring a soft smack sound on contact. Oof, says Jacob, pulling his hand away. You hit too hard. I laugh. He's such a dork sometimes. But the laughter makes space in my chest, clears out the fear and nerves as I reach for the veil. I've seen people on TV, ghost whisperers, talk about crossing over, connecting with the other side like it's flipping a switch or opening a door. But for me, it's this. Finding the part in the curtain, catching hold of the fabric, and pulling. Sometimes, when there's nothing to find, the veil is barely there, more smoke than cloth and hard to catch hold of. But when a place is haunted, really haunted, the fabric twists around me, practically pulling me through. Right here, right now, it dances between my fingers waiting to be caught. I grab hold of the curtain, take a deep breath, and pull. Chapter 2. When I was younger, I used to be afraid of the monster in the closet. I couldn't go to sleep until my dad came in, threw open the closet door, and showed me it was empty. Crossing the veil is like opening the closet door. Of course, the difference is, monsters aren't real. The closet was always empty. The veil? Not so much. A chill washes over my skin. For a second, I'm not backstage, but underwater. The icy current closing over my head, the light vanishing as something heavy pulls me down, down, down. Cassidy! I blink at the sound of Jacob's voice, and the memory of the river is gone. I'm backstage again and everything is the same, but different. The stage is faded, like an old photograph, but it's not as dark as it was before. Instead, it's lit up by a handful of spotlights, and I can hear the murmur of an audience beyond the curtain. Jacob's still at my side, but he looks solid, real. I glance down at myself. As always, I look more or less the same, a little washed out, but still me, down to the camera around my neck. The only real difference is the light inside my chest, a coil of cool, blue-white brightness that shines straight through my ribs, like the filament in a light bulb.
Like Iron Man, Jacob sometimes jokes.
I hold the camera against my front to muffle the glow.
Places!
Calls an adult's voice from the wings, and I jump. Jacob grabs my sleeve to steady me, and this time, his hand doesn't go through. He has more weight, or I have less, but either way, I'm grateful for the contact.
Act two,
the voice adds. And I know what this is. When this is. The night of the fire. In a flurry, like bats set loose, boys and girls in fairy crowns and glittering capes race across the stage. They don't notice me and Jacob. The curtains come up and the audience murmurs from the darkened theater. My first urge is to duck, to scramble back into the wings, but I remind myself that the audience isn't really there. This place, this space, this time, it belongs to the ghost and his memories. Everything else is just set dressing. I raise the camera, not bothering to look through the viewfinder. It's cracked. I snap a few quick photos, knowing that the most I'll see on the film is a shadow of what's here. A little more than normal. A little less than truth.
And to think, whispers Jacob wistfully, we could be in the cafeteria having lunch like normal people.
You can't eat, and I see ghosts, I whisper back as the second act begins. The fairies gather in the makeshift woods around their queen. I scan the stage, the bridges overhead, the props, searching for the source of the fire. Maybe that's why I'm drawn to places like this. Ghosts stick around for a reason. Maybe if someone learns the truth, if I learn the truth about what happened, it'll bring them peace. They'll go away.
That's not how it works, whispers Jacob.
My head snaps toward him. What do you mean? He opens his mouth to answer when a boy appears. He's short, with pale skin and a mop of black curls, and I know he's the one, the ghost. There's just this feeling, like the ground is tipping toward him. I watch as his cape catches on the ropes and rigging in the wings. He manages to pull free, stumbles onto the stage in front of us, but he drops his crown and has to double back. For a second, his eyes meet mine, and I think he sees me, and I want to say something, but Jacob presses a hand over my mouth and shakes his head. The music starts, and the boy's eyes cloud, and I watch him take his place.
We should go,
whispers Jacob. But I can't, not yet. I need to know what happened. As if on cue, I hear the hiss of a rope, and turn to see the rigging, the one the boy got caught on, coming loose, uncoiling. A bag of sand slides, sinks, falls, and as it does, it catches on a power box, knocks a fuse. There's a spark. Just a spark, such a small thing. But as I watch, it leaps to the nearest thing, an unused piece of the paper forest, shoved into the wings.
Oh no,
I whisper as the play continues. It doesn't start as a fire, not at first. It is only warmth and smoke. Smoke that goes unnoticed in the darkened theater. I look up and watch the thin tendril spread and thicken and coat the ceiling like a low cloud. Still, no one notices. Not until, at last, it becomes fire. There's so much kindling on the stage, a forest made out of wooden planks and gossamer and paint. It catches so fast, and finally the spell of the play is broken. The fairy students scatter and the audience panics, and I know it's just a memory, an echo of something already said and done, but I can feel the heat as it spreads. Jacob grabs my hand, pulling me away from the raging flames. Even through the panic, my fingers turn the camera crank, snapping photos, eager to catch something as the world around me turns to smoke and fire and panic. My head is beginning to feel foggy, like I've been holding my breath. I know I've been here long enough, that it's time to go, but my feet won't move. And then I see the dark-haired boy, trying to stay low, the way you're taught in class, but the fire is spreading so fast, swallowing the set on every side, climbing the curtains. There's nowhere to run. The whole stage is up in flames. So he goes down, shuffles on his hands and knees until he reaches the trap door. "Don't!" I call, but of course it's useless. He doesn't listen, doesn't turn. He pulls the door up and climbs down into the dark just before a piece of burning set collapses on top of the stage, pinning the trap door shut. "Cassidy," says Jacob, but I can't tear my eyes away from the fire, even as my lungs fill with smoke. Jacob grabs me by the shoulders. "We have to go," he orders. And when I don't move, he gives me a push and I stumble, falling backward over a wooden bench. By the time I hit the stage floor, it's cold. The fire is gone, as is the light coming from my chest. Jacob crouches over me, ghostly again, and I slump back, breathless. Sometimes, you see, I get stuck. It's like Neverland and Peter Pan. The longer the Lost Boys stayed, the more they forgot. The longer I'm on the wrong side of the veil, the harder it is to get out. Jacob crosses his arms. "Are you happy now?" Happy isn't the right word. The tapping is still there. It never goes away. But at least I know now what's on the other side. It makes it easier to ignore. "Sorry." I get to my feet, brushing the invisible ashes from my jeans. I can still taste the smoke.
"Rule number 21 of friendship," says Jacob. "Don't leave your friend in the veil."
The school bell rings as he says it. Lunch is officially over. Chapter 3. Before we go any further, I have to back up. You see, there are three things you need to know. Thing number one. For as long as I can remember, I've taken pictures. Dad says that the world is always changing every second of every day, and so is everything in it, which means that the you are right now is different from the you were when you started reading this sentence. Crazy, right? And our memories change too. For instance, I swear the teddy bear I had growing up was green, but according to my parents, it was orange. But when you take a photograph, things stay still. The way that they were is the way that they are is the way that they will always be. Which is why I love pictures. Thing number two. My birthday is in late March, right at that place where the seasons run together. When the sun is warm but the wind is cold, and trees are starting to blossom but the ground hasn't quite thawed. Mom likes to say I was born with one foot in winter and the other in spring. That's why I can't sit still and why, according to her, I'm always searching for trouble. Because I don't belong to one place. Thing number three. We live in a suburban town surrounded by fields and hills, and a fair number of ghosts, and trees that change color and rivers that freeze for the winter and 100 picture-perfect landscapes. These three things don't seem connected, the photos and the time and the place, but they're all important, I promise. Threads in the fabric. For my 11th birthday, Mom and Dad gave me my camera, the vintage one you already know about, with a purple strap and an old-school flash and an aperture that you rotate by hand. All the kids at school use their phones as cameras, but I wanted something solid, something real. It was love at first sight, and right away I knew where I wanted to go, what I wanted to shoot. There's this place a few miles from our house, a cleft in the hills, and when the sun sets, it sets right there, nested between the two slopes like a ball cupped in someone's hands. I'd been there a dozen times, and it never looked the same. I had this idea of going every day for a year, capturing each and every sunset. And I wanted to start right then. Remember what I said about being born in March? Well, for the first time that year, it was actually warm enough to ride my bike, even if the air still had a bite to it, as Mom likes to say. So I looped the camera's purple strap around my neck and took off toward the hills on my bike, racing against the sun, tires hissing over half-frozen ground, through the streets and past the soccer fields and onto the bridge. The bridge. A short stretch of metal and wood suspended over the water. The kind of bridge you had to take turns on because it wasn't wide enough for two cars. I was halfway across when the truck whipped around the curve and hurtled toward me. I swerved out of the way and so did the truck, tires screeching as my bike slammed into the railing hard enough to make sparks fly, hard enough to send me over the handlebars and over the railing. I fell. It sounds simple, doesn't it? like a stumble, a trip, a skinned knee. But it was 20 feet down into water that had only days before been frozen solid. And when I broke the surface, the force and the cold knocked all the air from my lungs. My vision went white, and then black. And by the time it came back, I was still sinking, the camera like a lead weight around my neck, pulling me down, down, down. The river darkened, the surface above a shrinking ripple of light. Somewhere beyond the water, I thought I saw someone, the smudge of a person, all shadow. But then the shadow was gone, and I was still sinking. I didn't think about dying. Didn't think about anything except the icy water in my lungs, the pressing weight of the river, and even those things started to fade, and all I thought was, I'm falling away from the light. They tell you to go toward it, and I tried, but I couldn't. My limbs were too heavy. There was no air left. I don't remember what happened next. Not exactly. The world did a kind of stutter, like when a movie freezes, gets jammed, skips forward. And then I was sitting on the riverbank, gasping for air as a boy crouched beside me, in jeans and a superhero shirt, his blonde hair sticking up as if he'd just run his fingers through it.
"That was close," he said.
At the time, I had no idea. "What happened?" I asked through chattering teeth.
"You fell in," he said. "I pulled you out."
Which didn't make sense because I was soaked through, but he wasn't even wet. Maybe if I hadn't been shivering so hard, maybe if my eyes weren't aching from the river, maybe if my head wasn't full of ice, I would have noticed his strange gray pallor, the way I could almost, almost, almost see through him. But I was too tired, too cold.
"I'm Jacob," he said.
"Cassidy," I said, slumping back onto the bank.
"Hey," he said, leaning over me. "Stay awake."
I heard other voices. Then the slam of car doors, the skidding of boots down the half-frozen bank, the distant warmth of someone's coat. But I couldn't keep my eyes open. When I woke up, I was in a hospital bed, and Mom and Dad were there, their hands so warm on mine. Jacob was there too, sitting cross-legged in a spare hospital chair. It didn't take me long to realize that no one else could see him. My camera was on the bedside table, the purple strap frayed and the viewfinder cracked. It was damaged, but not ruined. Changed, but not destroyed. Kind of like me. A little special, a little strange. Not quite alive, but definitely not... I mean, can someone really die if they don't end up dead? Are they really alive if they come back? The word for that seems like it should be undead, but I'm not a zombie. My heart has that steady thump-thump, and I eat and sleep and do all the things that go with living. Near death. That's what they call it. But I know it wasn't just near. I was standing right on top of it. Under it. Long enough for my eyes to adjust, the way they would in a dark room. Long enough for me to make out the edges of the space before being dragged back into the bright, cold light. In the end, I guess Mom was right. I have 1 foot in winter, and 1 in spring. 1 foot with the living, and 1 with the dead. A week later, I found the veil. Jacob and I were taking a walk, trying to wrap our heads around our strange connection. I mean, I'd never been haunted before, and he'd never haunted anyone, when it happened. We were cutting through an empty lot, and all of a sudden I felt it. The tap, tap, tap of someone staring. The shivery sensation of a spiderweb on bare skin. I saw the edge of gray cloth at the corner of my sight. I should have looked away, but I didn't. I couldn't. Instead, I felt myself turn toward it. I caught the curtain in my hand, and for an instant I was falling again, crashing through the surface of the river. But I didn't let go. And when I blinked, Jacob was still next to me. Only he looked solid, real, and just as confused as I was. And the empty lot wasn't empty anymore. We were standing inside a warehouse, the crank and clank of metal echoing off the walls, and someone somewhere was sobbing. The veil itself didn't scare me, but that sound, the sense of walking into someone else's life, or death, scared me. And I pulled free of that place as fast as I could, wiping off the veil as if it were just a spiderweb stuck to my clothes. I swore I'd never go back. I thought I was telling the truth. But a couple of weeks later, I felt it again. The tap, tap, tap. The brush of that gray cloth. And before I knew it, I was reaching out, taking hold, pulling the curtain aside, while Jacob groaned and sulked and grudgingly followed me through. And here we are, 1 year later. For most people, life and death are pretty black and white. But something happened that day when Jacob pulled me out of the water. I guess I pulled him out of somewhere too, and we got tangled up. And now I'm not all alive, and he's not all dead. If we were in a comic book, this would be our origin story. Some people get a spider bite, or a vat of acid. We got a river. Chapter 4. I mean, obviously Batgirl, Jacob is saying. The reissue, not the original. Sure. I scuff my sneakers against the street as we walk home. There are two of us, but only one shadow on the pavement. We're discussing which comics I should pack for Jacob for the beach vacation.
And we can't forget the new Skull and Bone, Jacob adds.
Skull and Bone is Jacob's favorite comic. In it, this dead cowboy named Skull Shooter gets resurrected to hunt down rogue spirits, along with his wolfhound, Bone. Jacob continues listing off options, trying to decide between Thor number 31 and Skull number 5, but I'm not really listening. Something is nagging at me. Back in the auditorium, when I was thinking that I could help the ghost boy by seeing what happened to him, Jacob said, "That's not how it works." But Jacob never talks like that, never says anything about the veil. I've always assumed he doesn't know why I'm so drawn to it, or how I can cross over, or what I'm supposed to do there. But what if he does know, and he's just not telling me? He can hear me now, wondering, doubting.
Rule number 7, he says, don't be nosy.
Yeah, sure, I think. But the very first rule of friendship is don't keep secrets. He sighs.
I can't tell you everything, Cass. There are rules to being a...
He makes a sweeping gesture at himself. What kind of rules? I press.
Rules like rules,
he snaps, face flushing. I hate seeing Jacob upset, so I let it go. Which is to say I totally don't stop thinking about it, very loudly in his direction. But Jacob pretends he can't hear, and I don't ask again out loud. You can pick 6 comics, I say instead. He pouts, but it's so over the top I can tell he's joking. That's what I love about Jacob. Even when he gets mad, it doesn't last. Nothing seems to stick. Fine, 7, I say as we reach my street. But I get final approval and no Batman. He looks aghast.
You heathen.
I tap my fingers against the camera, wondering if any of the photos I took in the veil today will come out. I notice there's only one picture left on the roll. Smile, I tell him. And Jacob throws up a peace sign. But he doesn't look at the camera when I take the picture. He never does.
Haven't you heard? He likes to tease. Pictures steal souls. Besides, it's not like I'll show up.
Click. We walk on, and a few minutes later our house comes into sight. One of those old Victorians that look like they should be haunted. It's not haunted. Except for Jacob. And he doesn't count.
Rude,
he mumbles, following me inside. I kick off my shoes by the front door, next to a tower of books. More books spill out of the study and into the hall. Some are research, history, religion, myth, and lore, and some are novels. And other books have my parents' names printed on the covers, the titles emblazoned in silver or gold. The Inspectors. It's a play on words, you see, because an inspector is a person who searches for and examines something, and a specter with an E is another word for ghost. So an inspector is a person who searches for and examines ghosts. My parents have written a whole series. They're up to volume 6 now. They're like history books, but with ghost stories mixed in. Truth and myth all rolled together. They're pretty popular. I stop and pick up the latest edition, looking at the photo on the back cover. A slim man in a tweed coat, dark hair flecked gray at the temples. That's Dad. He has a notebook under one arm and glasses perched on the edge of his nose. At his side stands a woman in pale slacks and a colorful blouse. her wild, dark curls in a messy bun stuck through with pens, and an open book in her hands, the pages ruffling as if caught in a breeze. That would be Mom. And curled at their feet is a mound of black fur and green eyes. Our cat, Grim. The overall effect is one part history and one part magic, with a dash of good old-fashioned superstition. The funny thing is, Dad doesn't even believe in ghosts. The book's editor actually likes that Dad's a skeptic because it keeps the stories grounded and more relatable to readers. My parents make a good team. Dad's the scholar, and Mom's the dreamer. He focuses on explaining the past, while she spins ghost stories out of maybes and what-ifs. And me? I stay out of it. Because my parents don't know the whole truth about me. I never told them what really happened in the river. Never told them about the veil, or the things I see on the other side. It feels like a secret I should keep. So my parents talk about, or write about, ghosts, but can't actually see them. I can actually see ghosts, but don't want to talk, or write, about them. I'm pretty sure that's called irony. Hello? I call out. Anyone here? Mom's voice bounces down the hall. She's on the phone in her study. I can tell by the way she talks that she's doing an interview. Do I think there's more to the world than we understand? Mom rattles on. Of course, it would be sheer arrogance to think otherwise. She sticks her head through the doorway, her bun its usual porcupine of pens, and smiles at me but keeps on talking. Ghosts, residues, spirits, specters, call them what you like. She collars me into a hug without breaking her interview stride. Sure, science can explain some things, but when different people experience the same supernatural occurrence, see the same ghost, relate the same story, we should ask why. She turns her face from the phone. Dad's on his way home. She whispers into my hair. Don't go far. We need to talk. We need to talk. Four words you never want to hear. And I want to ask for a clue, but Mom's already pulling away. Oh, well, yes, she says to the interviewer. I have indeed felt the presence of ghosts. Probably true. I have seen them. Jacob waves a hand in front of her face. Less true. Weirdly enough, Mom kind of knows about Jacob. There are only so many times you can get away with talking to your invisible best friend before you have to explain who's on the other side of the conversation. But I don't know if Mom really believes in ghosts, or if she just wants to believe because it makes the world more interesting. She says she's had her fair share of paranormal experiences, and that sensitivity to the supernatural runs in our family. She says that when it comes to the strange and unexplained, it's important to keep an open mind. What I do know is that she doesn't patronize me about Jacob the way Dad does. She doesn't refer to him as my imaginary friend, and doesn't teasingly ask me how he's feeling that day or what he wants for dinner. If there's something Jacob wants me to say to her, she listens. My stomach growls from missing lunch, so I duck past Mom's study into the kitchen and make a PB plus B plus CC, a.k.a. peanut butter, banana, and chocolate chips, a.k.a. the best sandwich in the world, no matter what Jacob says. I think he's just jealous he can't eat it. I shove half in my mouth, put the rest in the fridge for later, and head upstairs. Our cat Grim is asleep on my bed. Despite the way he looks on my parents' book, in real life, Grim lacks what Mom calls basic feline dignity. Right now, for instance, he's sprawled on his back, paws up in the air like a dog playing dead. When I drop my book bag on the floor, he doesn't even twitch. I scratch the cat behind the ears just to make sure he's still alive, then beeline for the room that used to be my closet. Dad helped me convert it. We spent a weekend pulling out all the shelves, transforming the small space into a perfect dark room. There's a table with reels, a developing canister, an enlarger, photo paper, and pans for the chemicals. There's even a steel cable with little clips to hold the drying photos. Everything a photographer needs. Jacob is already there because he has no respect for things like doors and stairs. He shrugs, leaning back against the wall. Ghost perk, shortcuts. I lift the camera and crank the film, then thumb open the catch on the back, tipping the canister out into my hand. And then I close the door, plunging the closet and us into total darkness. Well, it would be total, if Jacob didn't kind of shine. It's not so bright, more like moonlight. It doesn't hurt the film, but it doesn't help me see anything either, so I still have to trust my hands to do the work. I pop open the canister and dump the film into my palm. Spool it onto the little metal reel and drop the reel into a developing tank, which is like a short thermos. Then I flip a switch, and the little closet fills with low red light. It casts both of us in an eerie glow, like something out of a horror movie. Jacob wiggles his fingers and makes spooky sounds. I add water to rinse the film thermos, then developer, swirling the container. While I work, Jacob rambles about whether to pack Thor number 57 instead of number 62. When the negatives are prepped, I hang them to dry. They won't be ready for a few days. I pick a negative strip that is ready. This one from another recent excursion Jacob and I took to an abandoned house a few blocks over. The house had been empty for years, but as Jacob and I discovered, it wasn't truly empty. I feed the strip into the enlarger, a kind of projector designed to transfer pictures onto photo paper. Then it's on to the printing. There's a kind of magic to exposing film. It's right there in the word expose, to reveal. I feel like a mad scientist as I move the photo paper through trays of developer, stop baths, rinse, and as I poke the paper with the tongs, the first picture finally begins to surface. My camera may be special, but it's not as strange as I am. I can take it with me into the veil, but it can't see the way I do. Most of the time the photos that show up are ordinary, a black and white translation of my full color world. But now and then, I get lucky. Now and then the camera catches a shadow against a wall, the lines like smoke around a body, a door to some place that's no longer there. Jacob hovers at my shoulder. "You're breathing on me," I whisper. "Am not," he says. "Are too." His breath is cold, a chill in the stuffy room, but my attention drifts back to the trays. One by one, the photos come into focus. There's a shot of the abandoned house from the outside, sunlight cutting through warped wood. And one from inside, a straight shot down a darkened hall. And then, a winner. It's a photo taken from the other side of the veil. I can tell by the faint gray sheen. And there, at the top of the stairs, the smudge of a ghostly girl in a nightgown. Jacob whistles softly. If I showed this picture to anyone, they'd just assume it was photoshopped. And even if they believed me, the truth is I wouldn't want this on display. I don't want to be like those TV mediums who stand on stage and pretend to communicate with the dead. And it's not as if the dead really speak to me. Jacob aside. I could be your interpreter, he offers. I snort. No thanks. I glance back at my fresh negatives from today and wonder if I caught a glimpse of the boy in his cape and crown ghosted on the curtain. I'm stiff from hunching over the equipment, and I kill the red light and step out into the bedroom, blinking at the sudden brightness. Jacob throws himself down on the bed next to Grim. There's no bounce, no dent in the comforter, but Grim's ear twitches, and a few moments later he paws at the air around Jacob. We've never been able to figure out if Grim actually sees him, or just kind of senses a disturbance in the force. Cats are weird like that. I decide to start packing for the beach, and drag my suitcase out from under my bed. I sort through my summer clothes, while Jacob pretends to rub a smudge of dirt from the hem of his t-shirt. I can't imagine having to wear the same clothes for the rest of my life, existence. Jacob shrugs. I'm just glad I was in a Captain America mood that day. That day. What happened that day? I wonder if he'll ever tell me. Jacob doesn't acknowledge the thought. He just rolls onto his stomach and starts reading whatever comic I left open on the bed. He spends a few seconds trying to will the page to turn before I reach over and do it for him. One of these days, he mumbles. Downstairs, I hear the front door open and close. A few seconds later, Dad calls up.
Family meeting.
Chapter 5 Family Meeting. Words, much like we have to talk, that never bring good news. There's a fresh pasta pizza on the table, which is another bad sign. Pasta pizza, also known as marinara sauce, meatballs, and cheese on a garlic bread crust, is my favorite food, and Mom and Dad only order it from Dino's on special occasions, or when something really bad has happened. It's confusing the way parents do that. There should be good news food and bad news food, so you know what you're in for. Mom's pulling down plates, and Dad's setting the table when I walk in, both of them making a lot of noise without saying much. Oh, I took that interview with Channel 5.
How did it go?
Fine, fine. Did you print out that contract? Jacob hops up on the counter, legs swinging silently against the cupboards, as I load a slab of pizza onto my plate. He considers the concoction of cheese and sauce and meatball goodness.
That's disgusting.
You mean amazing, I think, lifting it to my mouth. I take a massive bite. Cheese burns the roof of my mouth, and Mom snaps her fingers, a wordless reprimand for eating before everyone is at the table. Dad catches me around the shoulders in a one-arm hug. He smells like clean shirts and old books. When we're all sitting, I notice another red flag. Mom and Dad aren't eating. They're not even pretending to eat. I force myself to put the pasta pizza down. So, I say, aiming for casual, what's up? Mom draws a purple pen from her bun, puts it back. Oh, not much, she says. Dad shoots her a look as if she's abandoned him.
Cassidy,
he starts, breaking out my full name.
We have some news.
Oh, God, I think. I'm going to be a big sister. Jacob crinkles his nose in disgust, and I'm so convinced this is the news that I'm totally caught off guard when Dad says,
We're going to have a TV show.
I stare dumbly.
What?
Do you remember when the first Inspector's book came out? Says Mom. And there was quite a bit of press, and some people thought it would make a good show. There was a production company that bought the rights.
Yeah, I say slowly. But I also remember you telling me that it would never actually happen.
Mom fidgets. Dad rubs his neck.
Well,
he says simply,
there have been some developments in the last few weeks. We didn't want to tell you in case it all fell through, but...
He looks to Mom as if for help. She takes over, flashing a high wattage smile.
It's really happening.
My mind goes blank. I don't know what this means. For them, for us, for me.
Okay, I say, unsure what the catch is.
I mean, it's big news, but I don't see why they were so nervous to tell me.
That's great. Who's going to play you?
Dad chuckles.
No one,
he says.
That is, we're going to play ourselves.
I frown. I don't understand.
It's not a show,
Dad explains.
It's more like a documentary.
Mom can't hide her enthusiasm now. It'll be just like the books. Your dad with the facts and me with the legends, she says, talking a mile a minute. Every episode will focus on a different city, a different set of sights and stories. My head spins, and I'm trying to figure out if I'm excited or horrified or a bit of both. All I can think of are those ghost TV shows. You know, where people stand in pitch black rooms lit only by night vision cameras and whisper into mics. Is that what my parents' show will be like? And you won't have to be on camera, Mom is saying to me. Not unless you really want to be, but you'll be with us every step of the way, and we can go to the beach another time.
Wait, what?
I shake my head, my summer plans falling apart.
When does this start?
Dad frowns.
Well, the thing is, the schedule's kind of been fast-tracked. They want us at the first location next week.
Next week? When we're supposed to be at the beach? That's really soon, I say, trying to keep the panic from my voice. Where are we going?
All over,
says Mom, producing a folder with the Inspectors printed across the front. The most haunted cities in the world, that's the show's theme. The world, I think, is a very big place.
I'm more concerned about the most haunted cities part, says Jacob.
For a ghost, he really isn't a fan of scary things, or haunted places, or anything to do with the veil. For a long time, I didn't understand why. I wondered a lot, but I didn't want to ask. And then, one day, he must have gotten tired of my thinking it because he came out and told me.
It's cold, he said. Like if you walk out into the snow but you're warm, you don't start shivering right away. You've got all that heat to lose. But I feel like I just came in and going back out there into the cold, I feel like I'll never get warm again.
I wish I could slip my hand into his, give him some of my warmth. But all I can do is promise that I won't let him freeze, that I'll never leave him behind. Where you go, I think.
Well, Cass?
Asks Dad, the light catching on his glasses, so it looks like he's winking at me. So much for a ghost-free summer.
What do you think?
Presses Mom. Which isn't a fair question. Not at all. Parents love to ask that when you don't really have a choice. I think it sounds crazy and scary. I think I'd rather go to the beach. But Mom and Dad look so excited, and I don't want to ruin that. Plus, I shoot a look at Jacob. It could be fun. He groans. Mom opens the folder and my eyes track across the first page. The Inspectors, Episode 1. Location, Edinburgh, Scotland. What do I know about Scotland? It's north of England, which is an ocean away. It has people in kilts, and that's about it. I keep reading and come to the episode's title. City of Ghosts.
Well, that's not ominous, snipes Jacob as a thrill runs through me, half nerves and half anticipation.
I thought my life was already pretty weird. Apparently, it's about to get weirder. Part 2. City of Ghosts. Chapter 6.
Cassidy, the cab's here!
I shove the last of my things into my suitcase and sit on the lid to make it close. I was supposed to be packing for the beach. Bathing suits and shorts and sunscreen and a summer without hauntings. Instead, I've shoveled sweaters and boots into my bag. According to the weather app on my phone, Scotland's definition of summer is cold and rainy with a chance of hail. Jacob perches on the edge of the bed in his usual t-shirt and jeans, because ghosts don't need raincoats.
You have the comics, right?
He asks. They're in my backpack.
Do you have room for one more? Because I was thinking we don't have any justice.
No, I say, double-checking my camera bag for film. I'm cutting you off. Dad appears in the doorway, a suitcase in one hand, and the cat carrier in the other. Grim glowers from the depths of his cage.
Who are you talking to?
Dad asks. Just Jacob, I say. Dad looks around in an exaggerated way so I can tell he's just humoring me.
And is Jacob ready to go?
Negative, answers Jacob from the bed. This is a terrible idea.
Oh, yeah, I say emphatically. He's dying to see all the haunted houses and haunted caves and haunted castles. Jacob glares.
Traitor. I'm glad, says Dad brightly. I can't promise any ghosts, but there certainly is a wealth of history.
Grim hisses in protest. I zip up my suitcase and haul it down the stairs with a stubborn thud, thud, thud through the open door and down the steps to the waiting cab. I look back at our house, feeling a pang of nerves as Dad locks the front door. It'll still be here when we get back, says Mom, reading my face. This is just a change of setting, a new storyline, a fresh chapter. We have a whole book to write, she says, squeezing me around the shoulders. And how do we write it? One page at a time, I say automatically. It's Mom's favorite saying, and ever since my dip in the river, I've tried to hold on to it like a rope. Every time I get nervous or scared, I remind myself that every good story needs twists and turns. Every heroine needs an adventure. So we pile into the cab. Two parents, one girl, a ghost, and a ticked-off cat, and we head for the airport. Mom and Dad spend most of the drive talking about the upcoming schedule. The show has hired a local film crew and guide, and given us 1 week to shoot whatever we need. Dad is holding a folder with the history of the locations, and Mom has a notebook full of scribbles that no one else can read. The more I listen to them talking about the logistics, the more I realize this show has been in the works for months, even if it just came together. Nothing happens until it happens, and then it's already happening. That's one of Dad's sayings. The cab pulls up to the airport, but when we climb out, we're no longer two parents, one girl, a ghost, and a ticked-off cat. Because Jacob's gone. He does this sometimes, vanishes. I don't know if he's sulking or just taking a shortcut. The first time he disappeared, we were driving down the East Coast in search of haunted lighthouses for my parents' most recent book. 1 minute he was there, and the next, he was gone. I freaked out, afraid he was somehow bound to the river, that he'd hit some invisible boundary 10 or 20 miles out of town and gotten stuck. But when we arrived at the first lighthouse, there he was, sitting on the steps.
What?
He said defensively.
I get car sick.
Such a Jacob answer. I wonder where he really goes, what he does without me. I wonder if ghosts need sleep, if he has to return to the Vale to recharge, or if he's just being ornery. But as my parents and I check our luggage, go through security, and board the airplane, there's still no sign of him. And as I sit in my window seat and watch the ground fall away during takeoff, I really wish he'd stayed. Ladies and gentlemen, the seatbelt sign is now on. The sun's just coming up as I open my eyes and press my face to the window. It's hard to imagine that there is a literal ocean beneath us. A new world waiting on the other side. A world full of secrets and mysteries and ghosts. The strangest thing is that way up here, 35,000 feet in the air, wrapped inside this metal bird, I can't feel the Vale. There's no other side tickling my senses, no gray cloth at the edge of my sight, and it leaves me feeling like I'm missing a piece of myself, Peter Pan severed from his shadow. It doesn't help that Jacob's not here. I try not to worry, he always shows back up eventually. The plane gives a small rattle, a turbulent shake, and Grim glares at me from the crate under the seat in front of me. He doesn't make a sound, but his green eyes narrow as if I'm personally responsible for his current imprisonment. Dad's out cold, but Mom's awake and skimming a book called Spirits, Specters, Scotland. It looks pretty cheesy. The cover shows a castle under a full moon and tendrils of fog that turn to badly photoshopped spirits. But I find myself reading over her shoulder, and I notice there's a section on Edinburgh. The city, which it turns out is pronounced Edinburgh and not Edinburgh, is more than 900 years old. There's an illustrated map, complete with parks and bridges, churches, and even a castle. Still, the city is smaller than I expected, only a few miles across, and split into an old town and a new town. New town is relative, Mom explains when she catches me reading. It's still more than 200 years old. Old town, she adds giddily, is where all the best ghosts are. And where are we staying? I ask. I know the answer before her finger lands on the map. Right in the middle of Old Town. Great, I imagine Jacob saying as I lean back in my seat. I stare out the window as daylight creeps into the sky. I think about Jacob again, and start to worry about ghosts not being able to cross running water. As the plane descends, the worry weighs on my chest. By the time we land, I'm starting to panic. There's no Jacob on the jet bridge, no Jacob in the terminal, no Jacob on the escalator or at the baggage claim. And then the luggage starts tumbling out onto the carousel, and the first thing I see isn't the red and yellow stripes of my suitcase. Yes, I'm Gryffindor. But the boy riding cross-legged on top of it. He loves making an entrance. I sag with relief. Jacob hops down, shoves his hands in his pockets, and flashes me a crooked smile.
Ghost perk,
he says, and I can't decide if I want to throw my arms around him or slug him in the shoulder. Lucky for him,
I can't do either.
We pile into a black